This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, our weekly news magazine on listener-supported KDLG. It's Friday, October 23rd. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, state lawmakers are trickling into Juneau at the governor's request. Walker wants them to make some progress on the LNG pipeline project. APRN's Energy Desk reporter Rachel Waldholtz discusses what they'll be meeting to untangle during a special legislative session that begins tomorrow.
The governor has been very clear that he would like to see the state buy out TransCanada, so he would like to see the state take a larger stake in this project. And he would also like this reserves tax to pass. I think he sees it as the state's insurance policy.
Another issue state legislators are likely to soon take up could hit closer to home than the pipeline. At least one lawmaker says she plans to see the minimum school enrollment raised as a cost savings measure amidst major budget shortfalls.
Certainly, I have started legislation that looks at raising from 10 to 20. 10 kids in a school is not a lot of kids, and there's a huge cost attributed to that.
We'll look at that issue and how it could affect local schools, plus hear from one local teacher who is spearheading a grassroots social media campaign called Small Schools Matter to push back.
That's the point of our Facebook page, is to be sharing the pictures of the students from those communities that will be affected. We're almost at 2,000 likes already in a week and a half.
And we'll check in on a little ambassador from Bristol Bay who is receiving unique treatment for a unique medical issue at the Seattle Aquarium.
This is the first sea otter diagnosed with asthma, and so we're actually using a face piece that is modified for cats, and it's working quite well.
Those stories and more coming up after a brief look back at some of the week's news. Last Saturday, the Coast Guard suspended its search for 55-year-old Roland Briggs of Ugashik. Briggs went missing on a return boat trip from Igigik earlier in the week. After a multi-agency effort that covered some 8,000 square miles, Petty Officer Grant DeVoy said there was no way to tell what had come of Briggs or his vessel.
The Coast Guard, who was leading the search efforts, called off the search after 54 hours on Saturday. And we call it a suspension because we're able to reopen any search, any case, if any new information does arise.
Some debris believed to be attributed to Briggs' vessel was spotted by air Thursday, but no further clues had turned up. Briggs was the only person aboard the vessel and should have arrived back in Ugashik on Wednesday. The annual AFN convention in Anchorage ended on an unexpectedly tragic note when a Sandpoint man leapt from a balcony to his death Saturday at the Denina Center. Authorities have not released further information as to why 49-year-old Anthony Choquette took his own life during that event. On Wednesday, the state's new director for commercial fisheries assumed his duties. Scott Kelly replaced Jeff Regnert, who retired in October. Kelly has spent much of his career with fish and game in southeast Alaska. He says his first task will be drafting next year's budget, which is expected to include a number of cuts throughout the state.
But I'll definitely be working with the leadership of all the divisions and, of course, the commissioner on that whole process. And I know everybody's aware that it's going to be probably pretty heavy sledding, heavy going for a while. And then, of course, we move into the legislative session and work with the leadership there and legislators themselves until we have a final product.
The Nooshigak Fish and Game Advisory Committee met this week in Dillingham ahead of the Board of Fish meeting in December. The committee voiced support for ending free week fishing, came out opposed to permit stacking for drift and set net skippers, and backed its own earlier proposal to repeal the Wood River Special Harvest Area. The committee also opposed reduced transfer times for drifters changing districts or set netters moving sub-districts within Nooshigak Bay. Another person has perished in a house fire in western Alaska this fall. 39-year-old Denise Jones of Chivac could not be resuscitated after she was pulled from a house fire Thursday morning. Two children were injured but survived. The cause of the fire is under investigation. As Alaskans begin spending more time indoors and heating their homes, the state's fire marshal office is recommending fire safety tips like inspecting furnaces and stoves, and especially smoke detectors. Michael Warzowick says officials found working smoke detectors in only a quarter of the 12 fatal house fires last year in Alaska.
For smoke alarms, it's very important to have one on every floor, to have one in every sleeping area or bedroom, and one outside of the sleeping area or bedroom if you have a door. And then this way, if you're in your bedroom and a kitchen fire happens, especially in a small home, you'll hear that alarm go off outside your room first.
From our crime and safety beat, state troopers arrested a man in North Shore, Electinic Sunday for driving under the influence of alcohol. He's believed to be the first reported incident of that since the completion of the Wood River Bridge. 42-year-old Philip Larson of Dillingham was taken into custody after his erratic driving was reported by others. Troopers allege his blood alcohol level was three times over the legal limit. On Tuesday, a Shell Oil icebreaker gained two passengers when a French sailor and his cat had to abandon their ship in 20-foot seas south of Cold Bay. John Ryan had the report.
Manu Whatcom's ATN was sailing south after crossing the Northwest Passage in the Arctic Ocean this summer. Coast Guard video of the rescue shows the 30-foot sailboat bobbing like a cork next to the 270-foot Tor Viking. The Frenchman clings like a koala to the rigging at the bow of his boat. With a big backpack on and his cat stuffed inside his jacket, he times the waves just right. He dives over the rail of the icebreaker, landing headfirst with his feet flopping up in the air.
The sailor and the cat were okay. The ship was lost. And this weekend, wrestlers from around the region and from Bethel and Barrow will gather in Dillingham for the Wolverine Classic. Robin Cheney is a booster for the team and says it'll be an all-around fun weekend for all local sports enthusiasts.
Wolverine Classic starts 4:30 p.m. in the Wolverine Den. Barrow is already here. Max LeClaire, former state champ, Dillingham High School alumni, is bringing his Barrow team down. They actually got here last night. We've got, 70 or 80 wrestlers coming. Middle school wrestling will start at 4:30. High school will roll right into that afterwards and hopefully get three rounds in tonight.
More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond. I'm Dave Benninger. Tomorrow, members of the state legislature will begin a special session in Juneau at Governor Bill Walker's request. The governor would like the legislature to make some progress on the liquefied natural gas pipeline project, one of the top priorities for his administration. Joining me now to help unravel what this is all about is Alaska Public Radio Network's energy reporter Rachel Waldholtz, who will be covering the session from Juneau. And a note that since speaking with Rachel earlier today, Governor Walker has since announced that he will not introduce a reserves tax bill. Rachel, it's good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, Dave.
Can I ask you first, what are we expecting to see come out of this special session? I understand the governor has maybe changed his plan a little bit this week of what he hopes to see happen.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit unclear. The special session was called to discuss three issues relating to this gas line. The first is right now the state has four partners, so that's ExxonMobil, BP, ConocoPhillips, and TransCanada. And so the biggest issue on the table is actually whether or not the state should buy out TransCanada, so take a bigger stake in the project. And so that's one issue. The second issue, which is more controversial and sort of more up in the air, is this issue of a reserves tax. So the governor has felt that some of the partners have not been moving as quickly as he'd like, and he proposed the idea of taxing any natural gas that they leave unproduced in the ground as a way of sort of pushing them to work faster on the project. And a lot of legislators, especially Republicans in the legislature, really don't like that idea. They think it's trying to tax a project into existence. So this idea is really the controversial issue on the agenda. And then the governor sort of threw a wrench in it this week, saying, if we come to an agreement by the end of the day Friday, then maybe we don't even need the reserves tax, although that seems unlikely. The third item on the agenda is just funding the government to continue its work on this gas line. So all the different departments like DNR, the Department of Law, the Department of Revenue, and especially the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, which is heading up the state's work.
It seems the governor and the lawmakers will certainly be able to devote their attention to this during a special session rather than in the regular session. But as you reported this week, it's already off to a bit of a testy start between the lawmakers and Governor Walker.
Yeah, well, it's been sort of funny. The administration had planned this like five-hour briefing on Saturday to lay out all of the issues around the TransCanada buyout, around the reserves tax. They reserved Centennial Hall. It was going to be all 60 lawmakers. And then essentially the Republican leadership said, nope, and they scheduled committee hearings during that time. So in the middle of the week, the governor said, okay, fine, we won't do that briefing. We'll do it at 8 a.m. for any lawmakers that want to be there. So it's been a little bit of a back and forth. And the issue here is that Republican lawmakers are frustrated that they haven't actually seen the legislation, which as of Friday morning still hasn't been released by the administration.
All right. Do you have a sense of what the governor is hoping for in a best case scenario out of this special session? We're obviously not going to see a whole lot done, but what is his hope? And maybe what do lawmakers hope to see as a best case scenario out of this?
I mean, I think the governor has been very clear that he would like to see the state buy out TransCanada. So he would like to see the state take a larger stake in this project. And he would like this reserves tax to pass. I think he sees it as the state's insurance policy, so that if one of the companies involved in the project, like ExxonMobil, decided to pull out, that there would still be gas available for the project. That's how he sees it. And also he'd like to see the government agencies funded to go forward. So for a governor, that would be best case scenario. I think for lawmakers have been pretty clear, especially Republican majorities, that they don't like the idea of a reserves tax. I think the question around the TransCanada buyout, there's a lot of lawmakers that haven't made up their minds yet. They need to sort of dig into the numbers. It's pretty technical. You know, it really comes down to whether you think the state or TransCanada can borrow money more cheaply. So it's really sort of, you know, esoteric stuff. So I think a lot of lawmakers have come in without their minds made up on that one.
Rachel, while we have you on the phone, you've been reporting on the LNG project all week. Perhaps you can give us just a brief overview, a summary of some of the specs and the cost and the time frame of this mega project that still seems years down the road for Alaskans.
So this project is a $45 to $65 billion project, so it's huge. And the state's share of that without TransCanada would be about $13 billion. With TransCanada, the state's share is only about $6.5 billion. So it's really a $7 billion question, this issue of buying out TransCanada. And, you know, the decision on whether to break ground on this project isn't even going to be made until 2018. Best case scenario, the first gas would ship in 2024. So it's a huge project right now. It's just in its early planning and design phases. And we have a long way to go before we actually see this materialize, if we do.
Well, it will be interesting to see if some progress is made along those lines. Rachel Waldholtz will be covering for the Alaska Public Radio Network from Juneau for the special session, which could last up to 30 days. Rachel, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks, Dave.
Another legislative issue has more traction closer to home. Alaska schools need at least 10 students to qualify for state funding. In recent months, rural superintendents have been troubled by rumors that lawmakers might seek to raise the minimum enrollment in their efforts to trim state spending. Now, at least one state representative says she will propose that legislation, and rural Alaska schools and communities are starting to push back. KDLG's Hannah Colton has this report.
Since 1998, 10 students has been the minimum size a public school needs to qualify for state funding. Now, Representative Lynn Gaddis, a Wasilla Republican, says she plans to introduce a bill that would double that number.
Certainly, I have started legislation that looks at raising from 10 to 20. 10 kids in a school is not a lot of kids, and there's a huge cost attributed to that.
According to the State Department of Education, there are about 60 small schools in Alaska that would lose state funding if the required minimum count jumped to 20. Gaddis says such a measure would save at least $7 million, which is about half of 1% of the state's $1.2 billion education budget. That may not sound like much, but Gaddis and many of her colleagues, including Senator Michael Dunleavy of Wasilla, have said everything should be on the table as the state wrestles with a multi-billion dollar revenue gap.
I'm on the record and believe strongly that we should be looking at everything, every aspect of every expenditure that we do in the state. That includes education, that includes school size.
But that idea will meet with opposition from many rural lawmakers, like Representative Bryce Edgman of Dillingham. Edgman says his urban counterparts aren't aware of what's at stake when small schools close.
And when schools go away, sometimes small communities go away. And so I think it's just a bad public policy. And, you know, I think it's symptomatic of legislators wanting to cut things that don't really maybe impact their backyards.
Pushback against raising minimum enrollment is growing. Last week, the Alaska Federation of Natives passed a resolution opposing it, saying it would disproportionately affect Alaska Natives and other minority students. The Alaska Superintendents Association and the state's Department of Education also opposed the measure. And a new Facebook campaign is trying to bring together schools far and wide with the hashtag Small Schools Matter. That rallying cry originated in the Southwest Region School District, where Superintendent David Piazza says two schools have already closed due to dwindling enrollment in the past decade.
Portage Creek in 2006 and Clark's Point in 2012. You know, with Portage Creek, that community's gone. you know, Clark's Point, I think, has been able to hang on a little bit. But when we close a school, other members, other family members, you know, they have to move to try to find education for the students that are left. But that puts a big burden on those families.
If the threshold was raised to 20, two more of Piazza's K through 8 schools would face the chopping block in the villages of Twin Hills and Equoc. A third in Aleknagik hovers just above a count of 25. Neighboring school districts have similar stories. The Lake and Peninsula Borough Schools closed Egagik this year, and a 20-student threshold would see all but two of that district's remaining 9 schools closed. Farther south, the Aleutians East Borough this year shuttered the school in Cold Bay, and False Pass could be next if the minimum is increased. And so it could go in nearly 30 districts throughout the state. Edgman says that would be a death knell for small communities.
If you're looking at saving $6 million, there's other ways to do it without shutting schools down, you know, putting students and parents and communities really out in the cold in terms of the constitutional mandate in Alaska for everyone gets a quality public education.
How to best carry out that mandate in lean times is where the two sides disagree. While the Bush caucus will fight to keep schools in villages, Gaddis says the fate of villages shouldn't be a factor in conversations about education.
I think it's important for adults not to be looking at what's best for adults. We're talking about educating kids and what's best for kids. And some in places that do not have an economy, is it best for kids to keep a school open for the mere fact that that is the only economic base?
That's a point that many in rural Alaska say they'll be ready to argue come January. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
For more now on this issue, I'm joined by Megan Redman, the lead teacher at the Twin Hills School, where she has been for the past 6 years. Twin Hills has 21 students and 2 teachers. Last week, they began a campaign to hopefully raise awareness about small schools, who they are, what they look like, what they do, and why they want to fight to keep funding and stay open.
Megan, it's good to have you in the studio.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Let me ask you first, what is this movement, Small Schools Matter? Is this new?
As you know, there's been talk in the legislature about increasing the minimum number of students in a school for the school to receive state funding, for that minimum number to change from 10 to 25. There's even been the number 50 thrown around. So we do not want that to happen, obviously, as small schools. So my students and I worked together to come up with this idea.
This started in Twin Hills?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
Last Saturday, actually Saturday morning, Friday afternoon in my classroom, the students, I talked to them about what the issue was, and I had them write about what they felt and what they would tell the person that had to make that decision about why they should keep their school open. And the next morning, I set up a Facebook page. My sister's a graphic designer, so she designed us a little logo, and I set up the Facebook page starting with the picture of my students. I also sent out an email to as many building principals and teachers as I could from the list of the small schools in the state to get them on board as well, to get them participating, asking for pictures and quotes to help us post to our Facebook page. So I take the picture of the students and I add the school name, the village name, and then the student population, and then our hashtag Small Schools Matter. And we're posting those to our Facebook page.
So this is a very grassroots social media campaign.
Yes.
To bring student voices to those who are going to make some tough decisions in the year ahead.
Yes. And we recognize that there's a budget deficit in Alaska. This is a huge problem that has to be solved. You know, it can't be put off. Our legislators, they need to hear from the students. They need to hear from the parents. They don't necessarily want to hear from the teachers and the superintendents. Because, of course, I want to keep my job. I love my job in Twin Hills. But they need to hear from those people that it's really going to affect, and this was kind of our avenue.
Tell me how the students responded to this assignment. What is the kind of a common message you're hearing from them so far?
They wonder where they'll have to go. Mm. You know, especially out in Twin Hills, that's where they live. That's where they're from. That's where they've been their whole lives. And they don't want to have to leave. They asked, well, does that mean I'm going to have to move away from my family? Does that mean my family's going to have to leave Twin Hills? I can't really answer that yet because I don't know what's going to happen. And I certainly hope that doesn't happen. But that was their number one question is, where are we going to go to school? You know, what are we going to do?
How many schools are there in this list of under some of the thresholds we're seeing that mm-hmm. might be in that small mm-hmm. schools?
If the minimum number is increased to 25, there's about 60 schools in Alaska statewide that would be forced to decide if they need to shut down or not. If the number was raised to 50, it's over 120 schools that would have to close.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let me ask your opinion as an educator. If these bills are proposed and, when this is debated, some people will say these students can be provided as good an education, if not better, if we combine areas, maybe ship all of Lake and Penn towards Bristol Bay or maybe ship all of Southwest towards Dillingham or something like that. What's your opinion if that's an argument that's made as an educator?
I'll give you a statistic that I just got from Commissioner Hanley himself. You know, every school in Alaska is rated on an ASPE score. Every school is scored from 1 star to 5 star. 3 star is average, and that's a pretty good performing school for Alaska. And if you only look at the schools that have an enrollment of less than 25, their average ASPE score is 3.3 stars.
So above average.
Above average. So I think that's a really good example.
What about the value of being connected to your family, to your village, to your hometown, to your cultural resources? Is that important to the education?
I think that's very important. Kids need to know who they are and where they come from to be confident in themselves, to be able to learn. And our Southwest district has worked really hard to revitalize our UPIC program in the district. And it would be really sad to see that fall away.
So I would assume that if something is proposed, we'll probably see that in January or a little bit later this year. What's your goal for Small Schools Matter movement between now and the legislative session?
We want to get as many of those kids' faces in front of the legislators as possible. That's the point of our Facebook page, is to be sharing the pictures of the students from those communities that will be affected. I just got our 8th school picture. It's Akatan. And I'm hoping to get, if possible, every single small school on that list with the picture, with the descriptions to post, and have those pictures to show who this is really going to affect.
If people do want to participate, what do you recommend?
Of course, the first thing I'd love for you to do is go like our Facebook page. Every time the page is liked or a picture is liked, it shows up on more people's timelines, and it gets more and more visibility that way. We're almost at 2,000 likes already in a week and a half.
Megan Redman is the lead teacher at the Twin Hill School with the Southwest Region School District, who finds herself now leading a social media campaign to make sure that people in Alaska know that small schools matter. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Back in a moment. Let's turn now to Fairbanks, where the case known as the Fairbanks Four is being re-examined in court this month. Marvin Roberts, George Freese, Kevin Pease, and Eugene Vent were arrested, tried, and convicted for the October 1997 death of 15-year-old John Hartman. But since the four were convicted, many have charged that the case was mishandled, that the four men actually had nothing to do with Hartman's death, and that new evidence and testimony will clear them. The Fairbanks Four have become a rallying cry for many seeking more equity in the justice system. Reporter Dan Bross has been reporting on the court proceedings this month. I spoke with him this morning. Dan, thank you for being available for an update. You've been covering this issue, I think, for a number of years, but this bring us up to speed on what's actually happening. Is this an evidentiary hearing that's on day 17 or 18 now?
It's a very unusual situation. We've got what's potentially going to be a month to 6 week long hearing of evidence in a murder case that dates back to 1997 in Fairbanks. It's a case involving 4 Native men, 3 Alaska Native, 1 American Indian. And their convictions, they were all convicted by juries at trials in 1999, but those convictions have always raised questions because there's no physical evidence in the case. It's all circumstantial. And over the years, people and things have come forward that have raised enough questions that a judge is hearing all this evidence again, including some new evidence, some very key evidence in this case, and he will make a ruling on their request for exoneration.
Let me ask you about that, Dan, because most of what we've been hearing from your reports over the week, including these boot prints which were debunked, including new testimony that's been offered, including a polygraph that's now been passed by one of the four, it all seems to cast very serious doubt on their implication of John Hartman's murder. Is that sort of the sense of in the courtroom?
Oh, it's been very clear. And again, you have to keep in mind that so far we have only heard from petitioners, witnesses that have been called by the attorneys representing the four men convicted of these crimes. So this has all been somewhat one-sided so far. It does not mean that the state doesn't get to cross-examine these witnesses, but they're all witnesses that have been brought forward by the petitioners. As this hearing switches after today, I believe, it's not completely definite, but certainly next week we'll begin to hear the state side witnesses. So things could sway the other way.
Dan, I understand the state's attorney general may have offered immunity to one of the key alternate suspect witnesses in this case, as fingers have pointed right towards some other individuals that many believe actually killed Hartman. Has the state taken a new position on this matter?
Well, the state would like this man named Jason Wallace, who was convicted of an unrelated murder and is serving life sentence, to testify if he's given immunity from additional prosecution for the Hartman attack, which he told a public defender's agency employee about in 2003, that he had some role in this Hartman attack. Now, it's unusual that he would be a state's witness, so there's not clear understanding as to just what he might say and why the state would want that heard.
It seems like this is going to go on for a bit longer as the state gets their turn in this case. What do you expect, and what sort of a time frame for the rest of us to follow along here?
Well, we've got at least, this was supposed to run a month. It's obviously going to run over a month, so more than a week's more of testimony. And then when the judge will make some type of ruling is anybody's guess.
And could his ruling result in the exoneration of the Fairbanks Four?
It could, but although it's very likely that ruling either way will be appealed and this could go on. Also looming in the background is any action by the governor. He's been requested to, pardon them, exonerate them, something he can do. But with this hearing going on, he said he's delaying and listening to what happens during this hearing.
All right. Dan Bross is a senior news reporter, producer at KUAC in Fairbanks and is covering this month's hearing of the Fairbanks Four. Dan, thanks so much for the Friday morning update from the courthouse there.
Thank you.
Finally this week, there are many who just don't stick around Bristol Bay long, and we're going to wrap up with a story about one of them.
My name is Lasana Lahner, and I am the staff veterinarian at the Seattle Aquarium.
Okay, this isn't a story about Dr. Lahner, but about one of her patients, or tenants, or let's just say one of the marine mammals currently under her care. A sea otter who came to be known as Mishka, which is Russian for little bear, was found in Port Moeller in July 2014. Now Mishka lives at the Seattle Aquarium, where she has actually been making some national news since the summer on account of a rare medical condition and unique treatment that aquarium staff like Dr. Lahner have helped to provide. I spoke with Dr. Lahner to find out more about that, but first I asked for a little of the story on how Mishka, the Port Moeller sea otter pup, came to live at the Seattle Aquarium.
Yeah, so she was actually found when she was quite young in a fishing net in your neck of the woods. And then she was rehabilitated at the Alaska Sea Life Center until she was old enough to come down here. And then I actually traveled up to Alaska and the Sea Life Center and transported her back down to her new home in Seattle. And we're very happy to have her here.
That's good to hear. Well, before I ask you about the change in Mishka's health over the summer, let me ask how she's been as a member of Seattle's aquarium. Is she playful? Is she popular?
Oh, She is a popular little girl. She is such a sweet little sea otter. And, you know, she is very playful, and we were super excited to get her to our family because we have another young sea otter as well who was really harassing the older crew. So we have three sea otters that are between 12 and 18 years of age, and so that's kind of like in human years, 50 to 70. And then we had this little girl who we have this little girl who's two going on three. So it's kind of like having three people between 50 and 70 and then a 10-year-old. So now we have two 10-year-olds and they are having a blast. They are, anytime you walk by, if they're not sleeping or grooming, they're tussling and playing, and it's just absolutely adorable.
They also make quite, I would almost say, an annoying noise, do they not? I remember seeing videos of Mishka somewhere. And it's kind of a high-pitched
yes.
sort of a...
It's the pup scream, okay. Yes. No. Well, luckily that noise is not something we hear, you know, anymore. But that is a noise they make in their first 6 months or so. Sometimes they make it after that. But it's kind of like a baby crying, essentially.
And they
grow out of it. But it is an incredibly high-pitched noise. They don't hold back. They've got some serious lungs on them.
Okay, let's come to August when Mishka's health changed quite rapidly, I understand, and it wasn't exactly clear why or what was happening at first.
Correct, yeah. So I received a call from the animal care staff on August 22nd that she just wasn't doing well. And actually, between the time they called me initially and then the time I responded was able to get there, she was having trouble breathing, and it started to get worse. And so by the time I arrived, she was actually in what we would call kind of an asthma attack. But at the time, I didn't know it was asthma. You know, that's not the first thing you jump to when you have a marine mammal in respiratory distress. Typically, you know, more common things like pneumonia come up. So I did a complete workup on her and did chest radiographs and listened to her lungs with a stethoscope and all the same things that you would do for a human. And surprisingly, I came to the conclusion that she actually has reactive airway disease or asthma.
And this is somehow tied to or perhaps triggered by the wildfires that you had in Washington as well as we had here in Alaska over the summer.
Yeah, exactly. So it was that weekend that the air quality in Seattle was actually deemed unhealthy. Not only unhealthy for sensitive groups, but just plain bad. You know, we'll never know whether Mishka had perhaps asthma beforehand or whether this actually was the trigger for asthma.
Okay. So as I understand, you've been able to train Mishka to use an inhaler, and this may be the first instance that that's happened.
Yeah, you know, and I can't take credit for that as a veterinarian. We have some amazing animal care staff that has put a lot of time and effort into working with her, and it's all through positive reinforcement that Mishka has learned to breathe into a little mouthpiece that's an inhaler. This is the first sea otter diagnosed with asthma, and so we're actually using a face piece that is modified for cats, and it's working quite well. She's taking, I think, around 5 to 6 breaths now into her inhaler, so we're thrilled with her progress, and this has just happened over, you know, a short 2-month span that she's been able to learn to use an inhaler, so we're very happy with that.
How long do you expect a sea otter like Mishka to live, and what's her prospects there for the remaining years of her life at the aquarium? Will she continue to have friends and perhaps even romantic companionship throughout the rest of her time?
Well, she has no clue she has asthma at this point. She is frolicking and playing and diving like a normal sea otter. And sea otter, the females, live anywhere between 20 and 25 years on average. So we expect her to have a long, healthy life and very well-controlled asthma.
Very good to hear. Well, it's nice to have an update on one of our ambassadors from Bristol Bay and Dr. Lasana Lahner from the Seattle Aquarium. Thank you so much for the update.
Yeah, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
By the way, Mishka was deemed unreleasable because she never learned survival skills in the wild. And Mishka's not the only sea otter from Bristol Bay we know about who's gone on to do good things down south. Another found and rescued from Port Hyden in 2012 was later flown by FedEx to Pittsburgh, where he still seems to be doing well at the zoo there. We're out of time, so that's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond. Find this in past episodes at our website, and please send that feedback and those story ideas, plus your op-ed, pitches, essays, and more to me at dave@kdlg.org.
I'll see many of you at the wrestling tournament in Dillingham this weekend and hope to see all of you back here again next week. Thank you.